Welcome. It's very exciting to be here today. There is a huge demonstration in Lausanne at the moment. And I'm here to represent the Kurdish women's movement in Switzerland. My name is Özen. Today, I'm going to try a little bit, because it's difficult to treat these themes other than superficially. But I'm going to try to speak in a short way about the revolution in Rojava, really about the start of the revolution, the start that we in the world didn't necessarily follow. So we, as a Kurdish movement, have to talk about the 19th of July 2012 in this way. We have to admit that there was a revolution going on that the world was ignoring. Of course, the situation in Syria at that moment was a war situation. And the revolution in Rojava that was born in that moment was a turning point in the history of humanity, because it's the beginning to subvert 6,000 years of patriarchy. It's to show that another way is possible, another accent is possible. This was 11 years ago. Since the revolution in Rojava has been going on, the situation, of course, is that attacks are constant. But there's hope for all of us, because this revolution stays strong, because it's hope for equality, liberty, democratic life, for the people in Kurdistan, for the people in Syria, but also in the Middle East, and the entire world has a hope in this revolution, because it shows us that change of this world is possible. I'm sorry at this point that everything is German. I hadn't thought that far, but what happened? So the Kurdish liberation movement sees the revolution in Rojava like a lock to show the world what democratic confederalism can look like. I'm going to talk more about democratic confederalism later. The people in Kurdistan weren't the only people that were part of this revolution. After people that were holding these spaces were chased away from the areas that they were holding, the theory of democratic confederalism that existed until then was called into life to allow the structure of revolution that was acting to reinforce us with our blood. So if we think about revolution as a skeleton, then we gave it life through democratic federalism. And that was the idea. And it's based on the writings of Abdullah Öcalan, who, through an international complot that was arrested in Nigeria because Turkey orchestrated this arrest, and since then he's been in solitary confinement. In his writings during his time in solitary confinement, he developed these ideas of democratic confederalism with ideas of different philosophers, and developed this idea of possible life in a collective. Until then, in Rojava, through the revolution, there was a basic democracy which was created, which has to do with turning structures, and which turned around the Western model of hierarchies, meaning that the people are put in the first place. I'm going to talk more about the structure of the wheel or the turning in the rotations. But besides the organization, there's a civil structure, which is a very important part of democratic confederalism. A very important element of this is also that it's a women's revolution, it's an revolution of ecology, and it's a revolution that showed that this war, this never-ending war in the Middle East, is not necessary, because the people there are puppets of capitalism and of fascism. And by waging war against each other and by standing in a state of animosity against each other, they're actually helping the person who's exploiting them, the system that's exploiting them. After the revolution in Rojava marked the end of the hierarchy of the state, and the society started self-governing. So what we mean by this society, we're going to go into more detail, but it is people that are in Kurdistan, but a lot of different people and a lot of religious minorities and ethnic minorities live together, and all of them together form the society that in Rojava has the directives and the executive. You see an image above which shows an assembly, a general assembly where all the people come together and make decisions. And it showed that during those 11 years, it's possible to change the potential so that the theory can become praxis. If people are ready to resist in this form, to get together in this form, and to accept each other in this form of self-governance, it shows that it's possible for a human to remain a human. This is what we saw in Rojava. We also saw that we didn't need a state. I think that's the most important aspect, that this formation of state that we have in our head, this is what the model in Rojava challenged. It's not necessary. Life is possible without this form of the state. Of course, building up the Rojava revolution was something that the world witnessed, but the enemies witnessed it as well, of course. Namely, we have a traditional image of the enemy. Our geography has been divided through the Pact of Lausanne, which is celebrating the 100 years tomorrow. And these enemies that need the opposition between the different peoples, that need the animosity between people, are the ones who then present themselves as saviors through military intervention to sort of save the war and to put an end to the war, and through that keep their authority. So what we've showed in Rojava is that this is not necessary. The historical enemy for us is Turkey, the Turkish state, which continues to remove people from the areas that they occupy in Rojava, because our existence is a problem for the existence of the Turkish state.
So the Turkey tried to extend their borders through the war. So, So they went out of their borders and they took the territory of other countries. But the thing is that the IS, which the Islamic State, so the source of the IS, it can be from the US. We know the IS. So when they came to Kurdistan, well, to Turkey and Syria and in Kobane, what the Turkey did, it's the black side of the world. The IS is really a black side from how they act. And the Turkey did give logistic stuff to the IS, and also because they make the IS work against the Kurdish revolution in Rojava. And the thing is that the Turkey used the IS because they were against the revolution that was happening in the Rojava, and also Occidental states did support the IS because they don't want a revolution, or they don't want to show that a revolution is possible in a part of the world. So yes, so the EU did support the IS in the logistical stuff, and they did know that the IS was working in Syria, and they did give them like, okay, sorry. So the Islamic State, the Turkey let the IS in cities to work out. So in the revolution of Rojava is the world. Well, the revolution shows how the imperialism is acting in the world. So that's why the IS did get some help in practical situation in Turkey from Turkey. And so there was like hospitals, they were made on the borders of Rojava, and the Turkey did like helped the people working for the IS. So they did give also military help from the Americans, so the IS. And I mean, they did get stuff from them, and all the logistical, how like the transport and other stuff, because the world didn't want that the revolution works, so they did make a pact with the IS. So the IS is not only in Syria, Turkey present, but also in Senegal. And as you can see, they made an attack. So the tragedy. So
that was based in 2014.
There was an attempt of ethnic cleansing in Shengal. There were 74 different attempts to murder the Peshmerga people of the Democratic Party and of the Kurdistan Working Party. Our best estimation is that between 10,000 people, over 10,000 people died of the last attempt of genocide. Over 7,000 women were kidnapped by the Islamic State, but more than 400,000 people, almost 500,000 people, had to flee their home region. Recently, three guerrilla fighters of the PKK could save thousands of people through a humanitarian corridor. We were lucky because they probably thought that there were more of us. We were lucky that the fighters were able to take a few weapons, but it was three women. That was the first time that the self-defense forces, the women's army and the people's defense army had a direct clash with the Islamic State. Shortly after Shengal, there was the second clash in Kobane. The fight about Kobane was the turning point of the Rojava Revolution. Namely, we can look at this from two perspectives. First, the Kurdish units showed that they're ready to fight until the bitter end to defend their revolution and their country against the Islamist fighters. And secondly, the world started to look at the Rojava Revolution differently because of this fight. The Islamic State was a lot stronger in terms of weapons because they got weapons from different forces in the Western world, as we showed. They were able to do large-scale attacks through Turkey. So really, it's one city that was divided through the Lausanne contract. Part of it was in Rojava, part of it was in Turkey. The Islamic State also had support for from Turkey for things like looking after their fighters after they were wounded in conflict. But Rojava was the only unit of fighters in the Middle East that decidedly took a stand against the Islamic State. At this point in 2014, it was the self-defense forces in Rojava. And later, this became the United Forces. But what's also very important is that these people who were standing in solidarity here in Switzerland, in Europe, it gave support and it showed that in the world there was an open understanding that this attack on the Islamic State was going on. This is what forced the Arab Alliance to attack. They then created a defense alliance against the Islamic State. One of these anti-IS coalitions was called the Democratic Forces of Syria, the QSD, and that's how they fought back against the Islamic State. That was the big military defeat for the Islamic State. That was the beginning of the end for them. But, you know, here we're talking about the attack on Shengal, the start of the revolution going on and holding on. But to be able to hold this had a very high cost. We lost friends, we lost family members on this way. around 11,000 fighters lost their lives. 21,000 people were hurt or maimed, and 5,000 of them have permanent war traumas from it. But another point, of course, is that the victory against the Islamic State does not mean that Rojava prevailed. The structures in Rojava are still not recognized internationally. We're still having discussions. We're still asking for this on the streets. We're still asking to be recognized. Because recognition means that the power interests of capital would lose their structure, that which holds them alive, their system. This structure that I witnessed after the victory over the Islamic State, this image on the left, really shook me. How all sorts of life can be blown out of a city. And then a friend said to me, this is just the skeleton. We're going to fill it with life again. What's important is that this skeleton is there. The rest will do. And this is after this image, the center of the city. It's a statue of Arin Milkan. She's a fighter who to keep the Islamic State from taking the city entirely, she was a suicide bomber who went under a tank and blew up the tank to keep the Islamic State from attacking her friends and her family and to keep the city safe. So I think it's important for all of us, not just us in Rojava, but everywhere. This is an image of a fighter who still has repercussions from this war, but it doesn't take away her joy of life. It's important to know that if you have a will for life, if you have a will to build a future, not just for yourself, but for others too, to see that living for others is possible. And it's possible to make this a reality if we recognize that we are not the kings of this world, but we are part of nature. If we understand that improving life for others is good for ourselves, for the collective and for ourselves. It's important if you and I believe this, because then we become a we. And it's possible to hold on and through life and through fights to create a resistance.
So this was the part about the revolution and the Battle of Rojava. How I said, it's just a little picture of it. But now the next part is about the democratic confederalism, and the idea that was in the Rojava revolution is to be used for the rest of the world. So there is months conferences about this. So here we're just going to take a little picture of it. We won't understand anything, but you will see a little bit of it. And we will see also the development of this idea. So we will only see a little part of it. So what is important, it's the question that the Kurdish ask. So is this not a problem of ethnicity or of national sovereignty? And the second point is the it's the freeing of the society and the idea of the democracy, which is in a form of a national, but is from bottom up, which is really a democracy. So, and as last point, for the Kurdish, for the revolution of the Kurdish, which we can make a link to the modern capitalistic system, and we can ask and criticize it. So without the link between the revolution and the global world, we will get an answer which can open the way of another solution for our societies. Here is a picture of an assembly. So as you can see, on the top of it, there is like the different flags of different religions. So the idea is coming from Abdullah Öcalan, which is the co-founder of the PKK, so the Workers' Party. He since the 1999, he is in prison in İmralı in the Turkey, and he's in isolation. So he cannot see anyone. And his idea is it's not just the revolution of the Kurdish people, but it's an idea of the world to change. So the democratic confederalism is a political concept that is used in the Federation of Nurturia, Rojava. But this concept is also used because it's a kind of a philosophy that can be used in other region and canton and cities and commune. So the ideology of it is the communalismus, the liberty communalismus. But the thing is that it's a theory, but it makes sense in the practice. So it's really a practical way to think our society. So the basis of the system working in Rojava and in the Kurdin. So first, it's the national state. The second is the religion's relativity, because there's a lot of diversity. Third, which the diversity of religion makes question also the construction of the nationality. So it's not only one identity, but a lot of differences. The third is the administration and the bureaucracy as force. Better administration, but not up to bottom, but more bottom up, which would make people and the people act. In the democratic confederalism, the national state is the maximum form of the do. Also in this structure, there is the thing is that in a kind of a monarchy or monopolization process, there is a like there is a thing that it makes the society not move, and by making the critique of this monopole, we can change the system and make it and this would make the society not more in the hands of the multinationals, and but it would make it back to the people, and that would break the monopoly of the power, and would also make the ideological monopoly, which is a problem in our Occidental societies, and it. So this is the question, how can we change it? Because when we find a solution for the society, how can we share it to the whole population and make it work together? So that's why the ideological basics of the national state, which we are criticizing, is the first one, it's the nationalismus. Of course, sexismus and the religion, and also the positive, positivist economy. So this is only a part of the confederalismus democratic. There is a lot of other things. So we are seeing that the national state is like for of a religion, and this is why we have to break it by the criticize, because we think of it like something natural. We see like an identity, but it's not how we should see things, and that's why we need to criticize the national state idea, because if we break that, we can see something else. So this is really the ideology of the national state. And the national state makes racism, sexism, and patriarchal position, because it shows that it's natural and that you cannot change it. And the thing is that when you can't change things, you cannot see another way. So the Kurds and the national state, why is it strange? It's because there was a paradigm change. So since 100 years, we have a kind of state together, because we were shared at the Lausanne Treaty, and we would like to have our own borders. But what is clear, the formation of the national state and the ideological basics to know. So
for us, this national state that is the one that brought the situation of oppression about. So the national state is not a desirable state for us. It's not something that we want. It's been decades that Kurds have been fighting against the rulers, against the oppressors, and it's important that to know that they're trying to show the world that they exist. So everybody should know that we exist. We don't like many, many people in the Middle East just disappear because of oppression, fascism, and separation. We still know who we are. We still speak our language without having our own borders, despite the oppression, despite the occupation. meaning it's possible to recognize your identity without wanting to become a country. So Kurdistan is a paradox, we have to say it. So therefore, in the context of capitalist modernity, the national state is a center that does not have an important role for us. So if we don't offer resistance to this capitalist modernity, we could not liberate people together and collectively. For us, it's a collective liberation of peoples. And that, to me, is the most important point. The liberation of peoples excludes the option of a national state for oneself, because it only works in unity. Collectivity and freedom knows no borders. Freedom of peoples means that peoples have to be free when they come to our land, not just ourselves. And of course, the ruling class is the one that we're resisting against. This same ruling class is the one that is asking for borders. That is a bourgeois interest, but definitely not the interest of the people. That's why it's not our request to have a national state, to have a country with borders. And now we're kind of getting to the last point of democratic confederalism. Even if from the beginning of the revolution, we're going to talk more about the structure of rotation. As we said, the democratic confederalism is a collective inheritance of all of us. Knowledge and ideas of the entire world are combined in democratic confederalism. It's not just a political system. It's our history, our collective history, and the putting together of this history. It is the fruit of life and the fruit of our collective, because it belongs to all of us. And the state, which has the monopoly of power and of violence and the centralization of power, is the perfect example, a counterexample of democratic confederalism, where there is no center and there's decentralized decision making. The other thing that's important is that the society or the collective is central to decision making and not monopoly of power or capitalistic interests. And also, in opposition to centralism, heterogenic society structure is very important to us. If it wasn't like that, there would be a social eruption, which would break the whole system in its structure and in its strength. In this last part, I'd like to talk about the structures of rotation that were built up in the revolution, in the confederalist system in Rojava after the revolution. So, as I said, there's a philosophy behind it. And the citizens gain consciousness and sensibility in communal organizing because they internalize respect of nature and ethical responsibility. The the economical, human, and ecological development cannot be separated from each other. The system of democratic autonomy understands them as complementary phenomena and has an understanding of an economic system that exists separate from rulers and exploiters by strengthening the relationship between people and the environment. The cantons of Rojava The cantons of Rojava help through the cooperatives to organize from the bottom up. And they have a core principle, which is that all fabrics, all production centers are under the control of the people. In this way, there is an effort for fair distribution of resources. Inequalities in the distribution are going to be managed, and a fair economic order becomes developed. In the democratic autonomous cantons, the will of the people is central to economic decisions, decisions of production and decisions of distribution. Democratic institutions should include the entire populations and foster a feeling of belonging and a feeling of responsibility between citizens. And in this way, the people I come from a Kurdish women's movement, so it's very difficult for me to talk shortly. We're starting over. In 2014, when the Islamic State was vanquished, Asia Abdullah was a co-leader of the occupation of the autonomy in Rojava. And she put her ideas into these words that I think are very important as a person who fought there. Those are people who fought on the forefront. At that point, Salih Muslim was her co-partner who lost his sons in this fight against the Islamic State, but who still thought that the resistance had to continue. So, in the words of Asia Abdullah, we want, through the building up of democratic autonomy in Rojava, to create a decentralized democratic system through which, on the basis of a democratic Syria, all ethnicities, all identities, and all languages contribute, and in which women in all areas of self-management and of life have their own voice. For this, we will continue our fight. Our thing is freedom, peace, equality, and justice. For the fight for these, we'll give everything. Today, the nameless heroes in Kobani protect these values with their fight. Their fight wins its strength from this decision and their ethical values. Freedom will prevail. So, as we said, in Rojava, there's a system of rotation, and we're going to have a little look at how this is organized. So, there's many, many different types of centers and of communes in this local self-governance. These are put together in comminghe. People with different religious and ethnic identities self-organize in these formations. It is an ethnically rich area. There's Kurds, Arabs, Armenians, Kalyudirs, Aramirs, and the Mahlami. It's religiously very diverse as well. There's the Sunni Islam. There's the Syrish Orthodox, Catholic, and other Christ. There's Yazidin and Jews. And I forgot myself, I'm an Alevit. Those exist too in Rojava. An example that I took so that we have an image of this rotation system, I took Kamishlo. After the revolution of Rojava, Kamishlo became an important center because of its regional position. In the confederalist system, Kamishlo is divided in 7 areas. 7 administrative areas. Together they organize in a city council. Each one of these 7 areas is separated into neighborhoods. The way you can think about it is that each neighborhood and each commune is also a coming together of different smaller councils. So these are different levels of self-organization that come together first at the neighborhood level, then at the city council level in Kamishlo, then at the cantonal level, and then at the level of Rojava. In Kamishlo, there are 120 communes and 39 comminghes, which is, again, a coming together of 3 or 4 communes who work together. Smaller cities that are in theory not a part of Kamishlo but become part of this administrative area and organized together. So for example, in Girbawi there are 38 communes and in Tinuire there are 15 communes that are linked to the council in Kamishlo. So they organize together and have the same rights as the people who organize centrally in Kamishlo. In each of these communes, there are between 150 and 3,000 people who self-organize in this structure. It's about this size. Of course, in some areas, there are, for example, high-rises. It's a more urban areas, so it's more densely populated. In other areas that are more peri-rural, it's less densely populated, so there are less people. These communes and commissions are responsible for different areas of work. This is not limited, but there's this economy that is acting in the name of the people, the security, ashaish, which has to happen there too. It has to do with self-defense and defense of the area as well. Health, culture, and conflict management and conflict. Conflict management. There's no justice system as it's known here. But first, there's a level of conflict management where there's a discussion between the different parties. There's also a justice commission, but the entire council contributes to these decisions of justice. So there's not single judges or people who are responsible for this, but it's the entire council. This is very difficult. These are very long processes. Women are often more strict in these commissions of punishment. So this is why it's also important to have friends who come and to help with this. Then, of course, there's also organizations of civil society, like, for example, support for families whose children died during this war, families of martyrs. What's also important is that commissions can also be created as the need arises. So, for example, if we feel like there's the need for a commission of a foreign language or for education, then there can be a request for it, and then this commission can be created. But the basics are these that I mentioned: economy, security, health, culture, conflict management. And then there's the gender parity double head of the co-occupation to be at the helm of this. These are people, always one man and one woman of different religious identities, and they're elected by the council, and they change every 2 years. Any one of the people in Rojava can be elected to this position. The other thing that's important is to say that these are general structures, which for us means that there's a quota for peoples, for gender, and for beliefs or religion. So, depending on how many Kalde live in Kamishlo, 40% of them have to be in the council. Otherwise, the council can't make decisions. A second important aspect is that all of these commissions exist for women as well. Without there are the same commissions that exist for the women's commissions, but they're only occupied by women. It's important to think in Europe we have also this 40% quota in these different councils. It's important that there's not an informal rulership of men that develops in sort of an informal way. So it's important that there are structures of women that resist directly to patriarchal structures. Outside of exceptional situations, these communes meet once a month. That is always like that in rotational structures. In these monthly meetings, there are minutes and conclusions that are shared with the people and with the council of the city. The council looks at the minutes, adds its comments, and also writes a summary. This summary then goes to the next level. And this is how the different problems that were written at the level of the commune in one town or one city rises up until the highest level of the council of decision making. This is how we make sure that everyone is aware and informed of the situation and of the discussions at each level of decision making. This is how we can look at what sort of solutions or ideas for solution can be worked on together. Maybe water is missing in one region, or maybe there can be another way of dealing with conflict. This is also how we can see that this situation itself has an ideology of whether there needs to be support for a specific region. Okay, I'm almost done. This picture is not a council meeting. It's a party. People are arriving to celebrate the revolution on the 19th of July. People celebrated this in all of Rojava. We've talked about the system of councils, about democratic confederalism. But the attacks on Rojava continue, and it follows that our fight continues. In the last 2 days, there's been intense attacks against the guerrilla units in the Free Hills of Rojava. For the past 2 years, chemical weapons have been used against the guerrilla units and against the people of Rojava. Of course, the Turkish state has broken all sorts of laws that they've created themselves. In Europe, there's aggressive repression against Kurds, against representatives of these ideas. In Germany, there was a prison sentence of 1.5 years against an Islamic State fighter. At the same time, our fighters have done at least 4.5 years in jail. just to show you the comparison, 1.5 versus 4.5 minimum. This year, some of our fighters were murdered through the MIT, the Turkish Secret Service. Sekime, Leyla, and Filan were murdered in Paris. This year, or on the 23rd of December in 2022, another person attacked the Kurdish center in Paris and murdered Ernin Goy. They were a representative of the people who was always at this club in Paris. He was always the person who welcomed you, who invited you for tea when you came to this center. And Mitz Helmer was a an actor of culture. Heber Elvin was a fighter in Rojava. She worked on the ideology of this revolution. She worked to strengthen the women's organization. She was known as a person who had a very open heart. And she was taken as a victim 10 years later. We talked about the situation in Mahmur, which is a symbol for resistance for us. People who lived in Mahmur are people who lived in the towns in Kurdistan that were emptied by the Turkish state. These people fled from their towns that were occupied to the bigger cities, but in these bigger cities they didn't find peace either. And the United Nations resettled them in Mahmur with the accordance of the Iraqi state. At that time, it was a field full of scorpions and snakes. They brought it back to life. Internationalists taught classes there in English. The schooling there is democratic confederalism. But people have to go to the surrounding cities to be able to work, and they live in a state of embargo. There's been an attempt to build a fence around Mahmur to isolate these people, and these people aren't waging a war against someone. This is always a question of the weapon of ideology. No matter what we're talking about, the weapon is always ideology. And the thought and the fact that freedom can be made a reality. Şengal is still in danger to be attacked. It gets attacked consistently. Drone attacks by the Turkish state are constant in Şengal. And for us, for the Kurdish movement, asking for the freedom of political prisoners like Öcalan and all the other people who are in jail because of their political belief. They number 15,000. It's a central point for us to ask for their liberation. There are people among them whose official jail sentence is up, but who are still in jail. There are people who are sick and are in jail, who are not being let out, or mothers who fought for the graves of their children so that these don't get attacked in jail. It's important for us to fight together, to fight for a global revolution, for a global changing of this world. And we can only do that together. And it continues. We continue. Because this world, this nature, these ideas are ours. And of course, the streets are ours as well. And in this sense, for a global women's revolution, because the society can't be freed if women aren't free. Jinjian Azadi. I don't know what time it is. So we have some time for questions. We have time for ideas, for experiences. Depends how you guys want. I'm going to take my headphones in case I don't understand the language. No questions? One question. Thanks a lot for your presentation. I have a question about this double structure with the committees and the Committee for Women. How is that managed so that women don't have to spend twice as much time if they have to be in their own structures and in the mixed structures? Women who are in the general structure for this time, for 1 year or 2 years, are not also in the women's structure. They're being presented by the women's structure. So, for example, I'm in the external commission, and if I made a decision that I wanted to be in the general structure, then I would only work in the general structure in the external commission, not also in the women's commission. I speak German as well. I'm thinking about the question of how do people who are working at this level, at a higher level, I'm guessing that at a communal level it's a volunteer type work, but how do people who work at a higher level of structure, how do they get paid? I'm guessing they get paid. The European way of thinking, we can't start with a European way of thinking to answer this question, because everything that is won as part of this society is shared. So subsistence is given through the commune. So, meaning there is some voluntary work at the level of the commune, but the subsistence is assured because all of that is entered is given to the collective. So, the idea is always that you can take from others that which you need to ensure your subsistence. This is what it means to have an economy that is meant to work for the subsistence of the people. So there's also fossil fuel in Rojava that is sold, and that is also used for subsistence to get money. At the beginning, you said that the patriarchy is gone in Rojava, and I have 1,000 questions. You explained the thing with the councils, but I would like more details about how you're standing against patriarchy, for example, in everyday life. With classical gender roles, is it possible to transition in Rojava? Do people have access to hormones? Is there education about heterosexuality? I mean, I could speak hours about it, but would you give a few tips about how that works on the daily basis? The patriarchy is not gone in Rojava. That is the truth. If we saw the whole thing as 200%, we have a gender quota of 140%. That's one of the reasons is that the patriarchy is not gone. That's why women need to have more of a right to speak. The social contract in Rojava is still looking forward and is still progressive because this patriarchal and this feudal structure exists. The fight against this feudal structure is a fight that So, I said the social contract is so strong because patriarchal and feudal structures exist. Women and young women have to fight against this structure constantly. Punishment, when there's been excesses against the situations, are very strict. For example, if you work in the city or in the council and there's an excess or an attack against women, men can lose their work, men can lose their salary, and it can become directly given back to the family and the children. It's one of the ways that we fight against it. Another one is, of course, education. There's education about democratic confederalism in the native tongue of the different people. It's a system that is put into practice. In Kamošlo, there's a women's academy, a university in which the first students graduated last year. So education, which is very important in the Kurdish liberation movement, self-reflection is always put forward, that help maintain the stability of the revolution. So all of your questions and your ideas are very important to make sure that the revolution remain stable, that we always keep criticizing, that we stay self-reflective, and that we don't stay stuck in one point.
I had just a question about the part of the Rojava that is more where there is a bigger majority of Arabic people, like in Membij. I wanted to ask if all this institute, like the institution, the assemblies and the councils that are implemented in Rojava in general, if they are implemented the same way in Membij, for example, and if it's the case, if the Arabic community is as much involved, if there is something also. If there is a reflection about the representation of the Arabic people in this institution, or if it's a majority of Kurdish people anyway.
Yeah. So to answer your question, it's very important that all ethnic groups or religious groups are represented with this 40% rule of quotas. That's also true for Arabic people in Minbij, which was one of the Arabic states that fought as part of the Qasada. So we fought this fight together. And of course, a friend in Rojava who was in Minbij, this Muslim Arabic man was the head of this movement, but he had a lot of respect of this young Kurdish woman. But what she explained is that he has a lot of respect of Kurdish women, but she doesn't know how he thinks about Arabic women. So this patriarchal image of women in society, it's very hard to break. But our Arabic friends also see the solution in this proposal. And they also fought with us against the Islamic State. Amnesty did a campaign, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, in which they said that Kurdish fighters oppress the Arabic population. So we immediately entered contact with them in all of Europe. We occupied Amnesty's offices in different areas. But then the Arabic units in Rojava made a publication to say that they disagreed with this paper that Amnesty shared. They, as the people of the Middle East, they, as with the people of Rojava, live together in freedom and with the idea of peace. I think that's a very important starting point. But as I said, the social contract is so strong because these problems exist. But we're on our way to change it. And we take the next step to see this change. I've got a question multiple times, which is, for example, what's the role of queer people in this movement? From my perspective, of course, where I'm from in Germany, each queer person has the chance to become a part of a fight, because of course it's our fight, it's intersectional, we can only be free together. Of course, as long as one group is oppressed, that's not possible. But I wondered, because of this double places, what would happen if a non-binary person wanted to become a part of the highest level of the council, but they wouldn't fit the stereotypical gender roles? It's a very important point. I know fighters who were in the mountains, who identified as a woman and who joined the women's mangas. Because in the mountains, the situation is, of course, different than in council structures where the feudal structures are so strong. But in Geneva, for example, we have a woman in the council who is the co-president, who was the co-president of this council. And before her operation, she was assigned male at birth. So I think there's things that we have to overcome. It's work for us as people, but if we start just accepting people as they are, then one day society is going to be forced to get rid of these borders and these limits that they have in their mind. And there are a lot of people who don't have Kurdish ancestors who became a part of this movement because, for example, they were accepted by Kurdish mothers without borders. I know a person who couldn't identify publicly and everyone excluded her, and she said it's like a wall full of bricks and there's a formation of bricks and you don't fit inside. And then you come to Kurdistan where everyone has warned you and said, be careful, they're feudal, you know, don't worry, it's just that they don't know any better. And I met these mothers who just without asking a question, just gave me a hug. And for the first time in my life, I just belonged. And since then, she's a part of the Kurdish women's movement. So I think it starts with us. To not allow these sort of discriminations, and I think we're on a good path. I'd like to know more about quotas. How does this work in practice? When you say that you have 40% of each religious group, each ethnic group, and each gender, how do you get people to enter the structures? How do you create the sort of feeling of responsibility and the will to participate in different people so that they're represented in these councils? From an ideological standpoint, people know that if they don't do their part, other types of structures are going to happen and gain in strength again. I think that's the reason why I've been working on this since my childhood. To keep people close to their political, ideological thinking, to know that the only option is to continue and to not give up. Those are the holes in society that are filled through capitalism. Those are the holes in our family that are filled through capitalism. And these gender quotas, the putting in practice of gender quotas, is just as important for male citizens as for female citizens, so that this political position can be kept. We know that for us, it's the only and the last possibility to keep our identity. And that's why Rojava is so important for us also, because for all of us, it's a hope. And the right putting in practice of this confederalism shows us that every time revolutions in the past have faltered, it's because people moved away from their political ideology and these old structures crept up again, these structures of domination and of rulership. So 11 years, I think that is a long time for a revolutionary structure to hold. Thanks a lot for the super interesting presentation. I had another question about the council structures. I read that in some communes, there's also the classical political system. Is that still the case? That there's also other political structures next to the council structures? And the second part of my question is, what does the fight against capitalism look like? How many of the production centers are really under the control of the councils and the control of the workers? Practically, how does it look? In Rojava, there's only the council system. I don't know what time you're talking about, but of course there was a transition phase. Maybe there weren't council systems everywhere, but today it's everywhere. The cantonal council structures is applied everywhere in Rojava. And the fight with capitalism is for us an international borderless fight. For us it means to be there. It means holding on to our reality. And in Rojava, we can even compare that with Neolithic structures from 5,000 years. You don't make yourself rich from production. If I have more, then I share it. With this situation and this way of thinking, we can hold against capitalism by showing that another way is possible, by living differently. But otherwise, I would say that for us, this fight also means that we identify ourselves as that which we are and that which we want to be. So at the time in the Neolithic system, people were working in the fields and you took what you needed and the rest, the excess, could be brought to a general collection point. Maybe you had corn and you took the flour that I made. So there was a market system at the Neolithic times, which wasn't a capitalist market system.
Any political position in Rojava, like Kurdish people who prefer capitalism or something else, I don't know, and how you deal with it?
So, I would say we do have this problem in Rojava. There's different parties in Rojava, but they all end up in the same confederalist system. So one way in which this is an open wound is the KDP that works with capitalist systems and on a feudalist basis, which works with Turkey against its people, but KDP is not in the confederal system in Rojava. But of course there are different system parties, political parties that meet in the system. How much time do I have left?
15 minutes.
telling us more information. I'm Palestinian, and from the point of view of Palestine, I want to hear how we are, like, from the left party, and as international community, we try to get along with all international free fighting for liberation and freedom. And I want to hear if you, the point of view of your political party about Palestinian and the left party in Palestine.
So, I would say the people of Palestine, people in Kurdistan in the beginning of the 80s, when the aggressions against Kurdish activists started and became stronger, the first fighters in Palestine were in camps there. Öcalan was in camps in Palestine. He was with a lot people who developed ideas with the PKK in Palestine. Today, we don't have these strong links in our fights. The attacks and the occupation of a people cannot be accepted. What concerns the structure of Hamas, I can't say in terms of their position what it means in terms of as a women's fighter. I can't say how similar our positions are today, but of course we were in the streets together for Free Palestine, not just in Switzerland, but also in Germany. The resistance of the Palestinian people is similar or is in common with the Kurdish.
Maybe you not get me well. Palestine is just not Hamas, and Hamas is just one of Palestinian movement, and it's not left parties, more Islamic party. But in Palestine, we have three left political party and resistance, and one of them, Jesh Jabhat Shaabi, and PFLP is called Palestinian Liberation. And we have a big and very good contacts. And now we have for the last few years is just miscontacts. And in Palestine and here, we are present the left party, not Hamas or other parties.
I didn't say that. I was just talking about the general position and the general political position. I come from a women's movement, so this situation is probably just as much as you, as someone who's looking at this from the left, a problematic situation. But of course, we have these contacts. We have different Rojava committees in Switzerland and different Palestinian committees. And I know that these contacts continue. We can't limit our fights for the freeing of peoples. The freeing of peoples is the most important point in common in our fight. I don't know.
English. I wanted to know, you seem to be like trying to move away from capitalism a lot. But I don't know if I heard it. What's the role of currency or economy, or how does it work with Rojava and the other part of Kurdistan that might be in another country, for example? What kind of solidarity network, or how does it work when the people might be living, for example, in a different country that has a different system? How do you build that solidarity, like economically and financially? With the rest of Kurdistan, that's not in Rojava.
Okay. It's a very difficult situation because at the time, 2012, in July, when this declaration came that the revolution started in Rojava, everyone was just in shock. Because in the north of Kurdistan, just for context, Kurdistan is shared in four areas. In Rojava, we've done different projects, for example, to build a hospital. A school was built in Kobane. But the support from other parts of Kurdistan, for example, when the Islamic State attacked through the Turkish part of Kurdistan, so in the north of Kurdistan, was basically a people's revolution. So I think that there's a mutual support, but financially we can only support each other through this council system. And we do that, and a lot of Kurds do that, meaning that financially they support the areas where different projects are being carried out through different organizations. There's organizations that people can go to that work internationally. And this working together of all four parts of Kurdistan exists, but we all have different difficulties. I come from the north of Kurdistan, out of the part that's occupied by Turkey. Of course, with Erdogan, we have a dictator and an aggressive, power-obsessed person who tries to expand in the entire Middle East. His idea of a neo-Ottoman area brings up part of the same revolutionary spirit in Iran, for example. But for us, the guerrilla units that are in South Kurdistan, for example, are fighting from there. But they're also exposed to attacks that are sometimes supported by the Kadepa that are in Vasho. So it's a very complex situation. It's been years that we try to find a common objective and a common way of proceeding with the different actors and the different parties that are in different parts of Kurdistan, so that we're one unit and one strong movement. But as I said, we've always had historically this idea of the death of your brothers, the fact that your own brother, your own peoples are the ones stabbing you in the back. That's the situation that is often present in our history. But there's also a huge solidarity, financial, in terms of fight, ideological, that unites us and strengthens us. Since many parts of Rojava are occupied and there's continued drone attacks, how much does the will to defend the revolution suffer from this constant military attacks? And are people disillusioned or wanting to leave the region because of that?
Et l'impact des attaques sur le moral des groupes de résistance.
Afrin is occupied by jihadists, by Turkish jihadists and Islamic State jihadists. There's constant attacks, and I think at least in the Kurdish people that are living in this region, The most important quality is that they're so stubborn and that they keep going, that they want to fight until the bitter end, and they will. And we've already given up so much that we're just not letting go. For us, Afrin, because it's occupied, it is the part that needs to be freed. We're not going to give up just because it's been occupied by Turkish jihadists now. For us, this occupation and these attacks are always a reason to continue and to continue the fight. As I said, the Kurdish fight for freedom means for us to be present. If we stop fighting, we're going to cease to exist. No one's going to know that we're here, because we had to fight and we had to make ourselves present so that the world knows that we exist. And I think what's very important is that there will be a solution and an end to this capitalist system, and it's worth to keep fighting against it. This is the last question.
How do you explain that the democratic confederalism system that you described had been chosen? How did you want the support of the population in Rojava for this system? Does the council, for example, were existing before the revolution, or does it all has been created during the revolution?
Because it's the last question, I'm going to go in front to say goodbye. Before this revolution materialized in Rojava, there was this war that again ended with nothing. And through this nothing, the possibility of building something new became a lot easier, because through this long war, even before the revolution, a lot of people and a lot of friends in Rojava talked about this ideology of democratic confederalism. So this wasn't a surprise to the people. They were aware, and through this putting in practice of this revolution, they knew what they were fighting for. They knew what they wanted for after, what they were expecting after. And so that's why the fight was worth it, so that there was freedom and peace in the region. Sorry. For all those who still wanted to ask something, I'm sorry. We're not going to stop once we start. I thank you guys for being here, for your interest. And we'll see us in the street. We'll see each other in a better world. Fighting for a better world and for a revolution and for our future belongs to all of us. Jinjan and Azadin.